Welcome back to the Rav Hirsch on Chumash Parsha Shir. My name is Michael Gutman. This week we'll be studying Rav Hirsch's commentary to Parshas Va'era. And one of the main themes that we find in Rav Hirsch's commentary on this week's Parsha is Rav Hirsch's breakdown of the components of the Golus in Mitzrayim and how those components are reflected Mida Keneged Mida in the Eser Makos, and also in the Arba Lashonos Geula that we find in the beginning of the Parsha. So, first let's describe how Rav Hirsch breaks down the different components of the Avdos in Mitzrayim. And to do this, Rav Hirsch goes back to the Pasuk in Parshas Lech Lecha, where Hashem tells Avraham Avinu that his children will be servants in Egypt, will be slaves in Egypt. And Hashem says to Avraham, Yodoa Tedai, you should surely know, Ki ger yezaracha be'eretz lo lohem, your children will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, va'avodum, and they will enslave them, ve'inu osam, and they will cause them to suffer, arba me'os shana, for 400 years. And so within this pasuk, Rav Hirsch identifies three parts of the galus. There is ki ger yezaracha, the gerus, the status, their status as strangers in a foreign land. And then va'avodum refers to the avdus, the servitude. And the inu osam refers to the inui, the suffering. So the three components, according to Rav Hirsch, are gerus, avdus, and inui. Gerus refers to being a stranger with no rights in a foreign land. And typically speaking, in any country, citizens have rights. They have legal recourse if they are injured by somebody else, and if any injustice is done to them. Even the lowest ranking citizen of first rights will have the ability to be defended by the courts. However, someone who is a foreigner has no rights, and nobody will defend him. That's why Rav Hirsch writes that when we define a ger later on in the Torah, in Parshas Naso, a ger is defined as im ein la'ish go'el. The person does not have a redeemer. A redeemer means a defender, someone who will stand up on his behalf. So in the beginning, the first step of Klal Yisrael's downward spiral in Mitzrayim was that they were strangers in a foreign land. They had no rights, nobody stood up for them, nobody cared about them. And they were gerim. The next step was avdus, the servitude, and they were enslaved, and they lost their freedom. They, at least as gerim, well, they had no legal rights in the country, but they had themselves. They were free. They were masters over themselves and their time and their bodies. But as avadim, they lost even that. They were enslaved to the Egyptians. They had no freedom of their own. But then that was taken to the next level, and the third step, which is inui, which is extreme suffering, the avodas perech that they were subject to, where they were degraded and they were mocked and they lost all joy in life, Rav Hirsch writes. And so that was inui. So again, the three components are gerus, avdus, and inui. So to start, Rav Hirsch shows how we see these in the Arba Lashonos Geula, where Hashem expresses through various phrases of how He will redeem the Jewish people, and Rav Hirsch views these Arba Lashonos Geula as a reversal of all the conditions of Galus, but backwards. So let's read the pasuk, and then we'll show how they refer to these different components. In Perek Vav, Pasuk Vav, Hashem says, Lachain, therefore, and more livnei Yisrael ani Hashem. Tell the Jewish people, I am Hashem. Behotzei eschem mitachas siblos Mitzrayim. I will take them out from under the burdens of Mitzrayim. Vehitzalti eschem me'avodasam, and I will save them from their servitude. Vegoalti eschem bizror antiyo v'shvatim gedolim, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great judgments. So these are the first three we know of the Lishonos. We understand that they are Vehotzeisi, vehitzalti, vegoalti, velokachti. So, vehotzeisi eschem mitachas siblos Mitzrayim. I will remove you, take you out from under the burdens of Mitzrayim, the Sivlos are synonymous with the Inui. It does not say here in this expression of the Hotzei Si Eschem that Hashem will redeem the Jewish people and grant them freedom. Rather, it says that they will be removed from the extreme suffering. And so, after Hotzei Si Eschem Mitachas Sivlos Mitzrayim is accomplished, they are still left as Avadim. So the next expression rolls back their status, the Avdos. V'hitzalti eschem me'avodasam. I will rescue you from your servitude. So, v'hotzeisi eschem is a reversal of the Inui. V'hitzalti eschem me'avodasam is a reversal of the Avdos. And v'goalti eschem is drawn into yovishvatim gedolim is a reversal of the Geiros. Because as we described, a geir is someone who has no goel, no one to stand up for him or defend him or redeem him. So here Hashem, by saying v'ga'alti eschem, means I will defend you. I will stand up for you and take care of you. And so seeing how they have no rights in Mitzrayim, Hashem will take care of them. And Hashem will defend them and punish the Mitzrayim for the injustices that they have done to the Jewish people. And that's why the expression of Goalti Eschem is drawn into Yah is accompanied by the expression Uvishvatim Gedolim, that when Hashem redeems the Jewish people and stands up for them and defends them, this is called Shifatim Gedolim, great judgments. We understand that Mishpat refers to a code of justice, a certain standard of laws that rights that people are entitled to. So here as well, Hashem will restore their rights b'shvatim gedolim by restoring mishpat. That's why the makos are referred to as shvatim, because they restore the correct and appropriate standard and the rights that they are entitled to. After this, after reversing the Inui, Avdus, and Geirus, now, once they are free, V'lokachti eschem li la'am. Now we have the fourth expression, that I will take you to me as a nation. That once you are free and have human rights, now you become my people, says Hashem. And what's interesting, Rav Hirsch now goes on to explain how these psukim show how the Jewish people become a nation. And this is still without a land. All that's necessary for them to become people of Hashem are to belong to themselves. So first Hashem has to step in and remove their galus, all three components. And then v'lokachti eschem li la'am, they become the people of Hashem. Through Yitzias Mitzrayim, Hashem acquires Jewish people and makes them his. Then v'hoyisi lachem le'lokim, I will be to you as a God, refers to the first to Matan Torah, the next step. Once they become the people of Hashem, then that comes with certain responsibilities that they owe to Hashem. And that's the Torah, the mitzvot that we are responsible to keep. And that's V'hisi lachem elokim. And then the pasuk continues, V'datem ki ani Hashem elokeichem. You will know that I am Hashem your God, Hamotzi eschem mitachas los Mitzrayim, who removes you, brings you out from under the burdens of Egypt. And says Rav Hirsch, this knowledge of Hashem refers to the experience of wandering the Midbar. And the years in the Midbar taught them, helped them recognize that Hashem was the one who took them out, mitach ha-sivos Mitzrayim, but not just that Hashem took them out from Mitzrayim, but that Hashem continued to lead them even afterwards, and continued to be their God at all times, and led them, and looked after them, and took care of them. So these are the following steps. Once they become themselves, they become the people of Hashem. They get the Torah and have certain responsibilities to Hashem. And then the years in the Midbar give them the awareness that Hashem will be with them forever, and not just through this one experience in Mitzrayim. And after all that has been accomplished, I will bring you to the land about which I raise my hand as a vow to give to Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. I will give it to you as an inheritance, for I am Hashem. So Rav Hirsch again underscores the point that after Klal Yisrael is deemed from Egypt, they become a nation. They get the Torah. They learn to recognize Hashem. And only then they are brought to Eretz Yisrael. And that was the order in which it was to be. As Rav Hirsch writes, their existence as a nation was not dependent on their possession of the land. The other way around was the case, that their possession of the land was contingent on their acceptance of their role as the nation of God and their recognition of Hashem's presence in their lives. They become the nation of Hashem, and once they become a nation, then they get a land. Not that they get a land and the land makes them the nation. It's the other way around. And so here, through the Abra Lashonos Geula, we see how Hashem rolls back the components of Galus. And then beyond that, accepts Klal Yisrael as a nation. And then we see the role that Eretz Yisrael is to play in the Jewish nation. And that nationhood comes first. Nationhood exists before Eretz Yisrael, in Eretz Yisrael, and after Eretz Yisrael. It is not dependent on Eretz Yisrael at all, but it follows from their formation into a nation. Only then can they have Eretz Yisrael. The idea of the Geirus, Avdus, and Inui come up again later in the parsha with the Eser Makos. And this is, Rav Hirsch uses this concept as the foundation to explain the sequence of the Makos and the groupings of the Makos into the Tzach Adash Ba'achav, as we know from Rabbi Yehuda's statement that is in our Haggadah, that the Makos have been grouped into three sets of three, with Makos Bechoros of course being the final salvo that finally brought down the Egyptians and finally brought about the freedom of the Jewish people. But the three groups of three of the Tzach Adash Ba'achav show that they're each meant to express three different things. And Rav Hirsch explains that the pattern of three groups of three, in this pattern, the first of each group was meant to represent the Geirus component, the second of each group represents the Avdus, and the third represents the Inui. And the idea was that through each Makkah, Hashem wanted the Egyptians to feel what they had done to Bnei Yisrael and experience it and thereby understand how bitter it was and how unjustified they were in imposing that upon the Jewish people. And the Geirus, Avdus, and Inui was expressed in three different spheres. The first grouping, the Tatzach, shows Hashem's the Tzach expressed or let them feel the Geirus, Avdus, and Inui through Hashem's mastery over land and water. The second grouping, the Adash, let them feel the Geirus, Avdus, and Inui as through Hashem's mastery over the inhabitants of the land. And the Ba'achav, the third set, let them feel the Geirus, Avdus, and Inui through Hashem's mastery over the atmosphere. And then Rav Hirsch goes on and explains this and breaks it down with each individual Makkah. So Geirus, as Rav Hirsch described earlier, is again the fact that a Geir is a stranger in a land. And so through these Makkos of Geirus, Hashem wanted the Egyptians to feel that they were strangers in their own land. He wanted to show them that it is Hashem who gives a land to a country, and Hashem who gives people their own homeland, but they are only there by the graces of Hashem, and He can give it to them, and He can take it away. So the first of each set was a Makkah of Geirus. The Dam, when by suffering Dam, they experienced Hashem's mastery over the water, and they felt strangers in their own land, because the source of their prosperity turned to blood and turned to decay, and without the Nile River, they had nothing, and so they felt like strangers in their own land. when Hashem removed their river, the source, the source of all their prosperity, through the Arov, Hashem made them feel like Geirim by the medium of the inhabitants of the land, by allowing the animals to roam freely among people. And Hashem was expressing the idea that it is He who sets a barrier between the animals and people, and causes the animals to be afraid of human beings so that the people are safe. But when Hashem removes that fear and removes that barrier, then all of a sudden the people feel like strangers in their homeland. The wild animals came in, invaded their homes, invaded their land, and they didn't feel at home in their own country. They didn't feel like they were in control. They had no rights when it came to the animals. Finally, through Barad, they were strangers in their own land as a result of the weather patterns. That it never rained in Egypt. That's why the Nile was so important. And the irrigation they provided was absolutely vital to their success and their prosperity. But not only did it rain now, but there's a tremendous hailstorm, which they had never seen before. And so the climate change that the Mitzrayim experienced made them feel unsafe in their own homes, made them feel unwelcome in their own homes. They didn't belong. They felt like strangers. So that's how the Geirus was imposed on them, through both the land, the inhabitants of the land, and the atmosphere, through Dam, Arov, and Barad. The second Makkah in each set made the Egyptians feel the Avdus component of the Galus. So Rav Hirsch says that what leads to one group of people to enslave another group of people, it's the feeling of superiority, the feeling that these slaves are inferior. The masters dehumanize this group that become the slaves. They feel that they are inferior and they don't deserve to live, and so they enslave them. So Hashem, through these three makos, the middle makkah of each group, wanted the Egyptians themselves to understand that they were not superior to the Jewish people. Through Tzfardea, the frogs came up and invaded their homes. And from Paro down to the lowest of the Egyptians, all of them suffered from having these creatures all over them. And it showed that even these little frogs, which are generally timid and generally hide from people, but they were willing to invade their homes and hop all over them. And that showed that was meant to rid them of their feelings of superiority, that even the smallest animals or amphibians, the tiny frogs, weren't afraid of them, didn't respect them, and had no problem with invading their homes and bothering them. The Dever showed that they took away their possessions, because wealth provides a feeling of superiority, and so Hashem got rid of all their animals. And then through the Arba, Hashem got rid of all their produce. Whatever crops survived the hail were destroyed by the locusts, and that really undermined all the feelings of superiority that the Egyptians could have had. The final mak of each group was meant to inflict inui upon the Egyptians, just physical suffering. The kinim, which caused them great pain, the shchin caused them great pain, the choshech chained them into one place and forced them to spend 3 days without moving and just without any food or drink. They just have to stand in one place. And this gave them a feeling of inui, that the same feeling that they had inflicted upon the Jewish people. So we see now how Rav Hirsch has created a clear picture of how the Olamakos fit together, with each set of three being a Geirus, Abdus, and Inui set within a certain sphere of Hashem's mastery, all designed to make the Egyptians undergo the same exact suffering that they inflicted on the Jewish people, the Geirus, the Abdus, the Inui. And with that, that was meant to be a midah, keneged midah, punishment for them, so that they would understand what they had done wrong, and they would feel the suffering of the Jewish people themselves. Rav Hirsch has a very interesting piece towards the end of Perek Vav, where the narrative of the Torah is interrupted after Sheni with a list of families and names and basically the genealogy of three Shvatim within Bnei Israel. First, in the beginning of the parasha, we read how Hashem sends Moshe on a mission to the Jewish people with the Arba Lashonos Geula. Then Hashem tells Moshe, go to Paro again and demand that he send the Jewish people out of his country. And then the Torah interrupts by telling us, these are the families of Reuven, these are the families of Shimon, these are the families of Levi, until we get to Moshe and Aaron. And then the Torah says, these are Aaron and Moshe, to whom Hashem said, take the people out of Egypt. And then it recaps the previous command that Hashem gave to Moshe to go to Paro, and Moshe's protest again that he could not speak properly. And Bnei Yisrael had not listened to him, so how would Paro listen to him? And then the Torah proceeds with the story of how they go to Paro and throw the stick down. The stick turns into a tanyin, and then the makos begin. But what is this interruption to identify Moshe and Aaron's lineage? And why is it specifically here? Secondly, if you want to show Moshe and Aaron's lineage, then why not just focus on Moshe and Aaron's lineage? You could say that Yaakov had a son named Levi, and Levi had a son named Kehas, and Kehas had a son named Amram, and Amram had sons named Aaron and Moshe. These are Aaron and Moshe, and we go on. Why list the entire Shevet Levi? Why list Reuven and Shimon beforehand as well, which seems completely unnecessary here? What is the function of this entire list at this point in time? So Rav Hirsch says that we can understand this by noticing the location of the list. Until this point in time, Moshe and Aaron's efforts have been futile. They've been wasted, useless, nothing has come of them. Paro's made life worse for the Jewish people. And they've been unsuccessful. After this list, their mission begins to succeed and bear fruit. When they go to Paro, Aaron's stick swallows the other sticks. And then the makos begin. And slowly the Egyptian resolve begins to wear away, and Hashem's presence is felt by the Egyptians. So at this point in time, as their mission begins to succeed, the Torah wants to point out for us a very important fact that we must know. And that is that Moshe and Aaron were human beings whose origin was ordinary, and they were just regular people. And the Torah does this by showing a family tree and showing ancestors, and not just showing ancestors, but showing other relatives as well, and showing their full family tree, the idea being that they were known entities. We know where they came from. We know they were just regular human beings born like everybody else. Why is this important? It's certainly important because we see what happened when there was room to believe otherwise a few thousand years later. And that led to a tremendous misconception. And I will read this in Rav Hirsch's words because it's impossible to do justice to them. Rav Hirsch writes, "Now it is of critical importance to present an exact list of their lineage and relations, so as to attest thereby for all time to come that their origin was ordinary and human, and that the nature of their being was ordinary and human. Right from the earliest times, it has happened that men who were outstanding benefactors to their people were, after their death, divested of their human image and because of their godlike feats, were invested with a divine origin. We all know of a certain Jew in later times whose genealogical record was not available. And because it was not available, and because he brought people a few sparks of light borrowed from the man Moshe, he came to be considered by the nations as begotten of God. To doubt his divinity became a capital crime. Our Moshe was human, remained human, and will never be anything but human. So we see, says of Hirsch, how when family origins, when genealogy is not readily available, people can be deceived into assuming a divine origin for someone who is a great leader and who has done special things. So the Torah wants us to avoid any, the Torah wants to head off any attempt to deify Moshe and Aaron. Moshe and Aaron are human beings. This is their ancestry. This is their lineage. These were their parents. These were their grandparents. And Rav Hirsch wants it made clear that all these people are according to the Torah. They themselves could testify. They knew Moshe. They knew his family. They knew him from 80 years ago when he was a baby. They knew his family. They knew his sisters, his cousins, his aunts. They all knew everybody. They all knew where he came from. He was no stranger. It wasn't like he showed up on the scene. Nobody knew where he came from. And who is this guy? He must come drop from heaven. No, they knew his family. They knew where he was born. They knew where he came from. They knew everything about him. And now, as a human being, no different than anybody else, he had been selected by Hashem to be Hashem's messenger to the Jewish people, to speak with Hashem, to carry his prophecy to the Jewish people. And it's important that we know that he was a human being. It's important that we know that so that we, A, so that we recognize that it was Hashem alone who brought about all the miracles in Mitzrayim, which, as we saw last week, was a very important point that Hashem wanted to make clear through every step of the way of Yetzias Mitzrayim. It's also important because it serves that Moshe can serve as a model to us. The Rambam makes clear that anybody can become a tzaddik like Moshe Rabbeinu. We all have the potential to be Moshe Rabbeinu. But, says Rav Hirsch, there's a reason why the Torah includes Reuven and Shimon and other families of Levi in this list as well. And that is because we might think, well, Moshe was human. Every single human being there then has the capability to become like Moshe Rabbeinu just by virtue of the fact of being a human being. You don't need to do anything to become a prophet. Without any work, any self-improvement, anybody can just be Moshe. It's just by fact that you're a person, you can speak to God. So that's why the Torah lists Reuven and Shimon and lists other families of Levi and lists other children of Kehas as well to point out that if Hashem wanted to just pick the first, as Rav Hirsch puts it, to pick the first comer, to take anybody, then Hashem would have chosen the oldest Shevet, Reuven. And even within Levi, Hashem could have taken the oldest family. And even within Kehas, Hashem could have chosen the oldest family. And even among Amram's children, Hashem could have chosen the oldest Aaron. No. Or Miriam. No, Hashem chose Moshe. Why? Because Hashem chooses the worthiest and most exemplary of people to be his messenger. It's not just any human being. Not just by virtue of being a person that you're capable of being Hashem's messenger and being like Moshe Rabbeinu. But if you work on yourself to become a tzaddik like Moshe Rabbeinu, that's how the Rambam puts it. The Rambam doesn't say any person can be like Moshe Rabbeinu. Any person can become a tzaddik like Moshe Rabbeinu. It was Moshe Rabbeinu's tzidkus. It was Moshe Rabbeinu's work on himself. It was Moshe Rabbeinu's character that earned him the right to be the messenger of Hashem. Yes, he was a human being, but he worked on himself and improved as a person so that he earned the right. Every human being can reach the level to speak to Hashem, but you have to reach that level. You have to climb to it, to grow, and to aspire to a higher level. So we see it's important that we know that Moshe Rabbeinu was a human being, but it's important that we know that Moshe Rabbeinu was not just any human being. And the combination of Moshe's lineage together with some other families thrown in teaches us both of these points. And that's the importance of this list for us. And it's important to remember both of these lessons. and bear them both in mind. However, in the beginning of Perek Zion, Rav Hirsch points out that when Hashem sends Moshe to Paro, Hashem says, Re'e nesaticha Elohim lefaro, I have made you a god for Paro, because Paro will not understand a human representative of Hashem. To Paro, Moshe must appear as a god himself. He has to be some sort of living expression of a heavenly power, because that's how the heathens saw divinity. They saw divinity in the divine. There's no human messenger of the divine. No such a thing. So to Paro, Moshe had to be a god. But to us, Moshe Rabbeinu remains human. He remains someone with a family tree. He remains someone who was born like all of us and was a child like all of us and grew up like all of us. And hopefully we can become like him as well in developing our own character and becoming a tzaddik like Moshe Rabbeinu, which is a goal that all of us can achieve and a goal that all of us can aspire to. And it is realistically within our grasp. Finally, I want to focus on Rav Hirsch's discussion of the role of the Chartumim in the early Makos. We find that for the first three Makos, after Aaron brings about the plague, the Chartumim step in and do something as well. And Rav Hirsch makes these comments in the beginning of Perek Ches by the Sephardea, in Pasuk Gimel. The Torah writes, "Vayasu chen haChartumim belotehem," that the Chartumim did likewise. They did the same as Aaron with their secret spells or whatever it is. "Vayalu asatzfardim al eretz Mitzrayim," and they brought up the frogs over the land of Egypt. So, Rav Hirsch questions the role of the Chartumim in each of these Makos. Because if the Chartumim raised up more frogs over the land of Egypt, what was the whole point of that? If they were so talented, if they could be just like Moshe and Aaron, the point was to show, as we typically understand the meaning of the role of the Chartumim, they were trying to show that what Moshe and Aaron had done was not so special and that they too could work magic like them. Instead of reinforcing the plague and doing the same as Moshe, as doing the same as Aaron, why not counteract his efforts? Why not rid the land of Egypt of the plague? Why not get rid of the blood? Get rid of the frogs? Why do the same thing? What was the point of that? It didn't accomplish anything. So, Rav Hirsch says it must be, there's no other way to understand it, it must be that the Chartumim were trying to get rid of the plagues. And this is not the conventional understanding and the translation of the Psukim, but this is how Rav Hirsch explains it. He says by the third Makkah, by the Kinim, there the Torah says, "Vayasuchen haChartumim belotehem," the Chartumim did likewise, "lehotzias haKinim velo yacholu." So we typically translate "lehotzias haKinim" to produce lice, but they were not able to. But Rav Hirsch says, no, lehotzi means to make them go away, to get rid of them, to make them disappear. The Chartumim wanted to make the lice disappear and were unable to. And Rav Hirsch says that they were also unable to in the first two Makos as well. And the first two Makos, the expression used is vayasuchein. So what does vayasuchein mean? Vayasuchein means, says Rav Hirsch, not that they accomplished the same thing as we typically understand, but it means that they attempted the same thing. They made similar motions with their sticks. They waved their hands about the same way. And they, by copying Moshe and Aaron, that's Moshe, by copying Aaron, that was their vayasuchein. But what did they accomplish? Nothing. By the Dam, we read that they did the same. So Paro's heart was strengthened, meaning Paro hardened his heart despite the fact that his Chartumim could accomplish nothing. By the second plague, by the Sfardeya, we read, they tried the same thing, and this time not only did they not accomplish anything, but Vayalu has fired him last time. All they did was bring about more frogs, make the plague worse. Then we read in the next pasuk, Vayikra Faro Moshe Aharon, that Paro calls for Moshe and Aharon, Vayomer Hatiru El Hashem, and he says, Davin to Hashem, Vyaser Hatzfar Deim Mimeni Me'ami, that you should remove the frogs from myself and my people. So, according to the understanding, Rav Hirsch says, according to the typical understanding, that the magicians, the Chartumim, did their magic to say, show that they too could bring about frogs. So the Chartum were successful. So Paro is vindicated. So why does he turn around and call Moshe and Aaron the next moment? But the fact is that they were unsuccessful. And they were unable, not only were they unable to get rid of the frogs as they had tried to do, they only succeeded in bringing more frogs and making it worse. So that's why Paro calls Moshe and Aaron. And by the Kinim, as we saw, they tried to get rid of the lice and were unable to. And the lice continued to afflict man and beast. And then that the Chartumim said to Paro, this is the finger of Hashem. So in the typical understanding, we say that they were successful the first two times. And by Kinim, they finally failed. And so now they acknowledge this is the Etzba Elohim. So the first says, no, they failed the first time. They failed the second time. And after trying a third time and again failing, said, forget it. They said, if we failed three times, this all must be Etzba Elohim. Every Maka is Etzba Elohim. The Dam was Etzba Elohim. Sfardea was Etzba Elohim. The Kinim too is Etzba Elohim. We give up. So with this explanation, the first says, now the whole story makes a little more sense. We can understand what the Chartum were trying to do. Chartum were trying to counteract Moshe and Aaron rather than reinforce them. And they were unsuccessful three times. And their continued lack of success after three attempts made them finally exclaim, Etzba Elohimhi, that all these Makos are the work of Hashem. And this is a unique explanation of Rav Hirsch to understand these Pesukim and make some sense of why what the Chartumim's role was in Paro's mind, what he was trying to have them do, and how badly they failed at each and every step of the way.